From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the October 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Action This Day. On the 21st of October 1941, four of Bletchley Park's Codebreakers sent a plea for more staff and resources in a now notorious letter to the Prime Minister. Demand for Bletchley Park's work was increasing, and the organisation was facing a crisis. Churchill was won over, adding the note, "Action this day," to the document. But perhaps the changes that followed weren't just the result of the Prime Minister's influence. In this It Happened Here episode, Dr. Thomas Cheetham explores the problems the Codebreakers were facing, and how this letter was only part of the wider story. Thanks, as always, for voicing our archival documents to Dr. Ben Thompson. And to Geoffrey Welshman, who recreates the letter co-authored by his grandfather.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
It's now 1941. GCNCS has been at Bletchley Park for about 2 years. And by this point, the Codebreakers must have surely solved a lot of the early problems and settled down to work, right?
You would have thought so. But actually, 1941 is a period of crisis for Bletchley Park and Government Code and Science School. In this podcast, you know, we always like to relate what was going on here to the broader war effort, because otherwise, why did any of it matter? Mm-hmm. But this podcast is more about Bletchley Park itself and events in Britain and how code breaking was organised. So it quite literally is an It Happened Here. Now, clearly the code breakers have been really successful by this point in the war, but the system at Bletchley is starting to creak just under the weight of the effort and the limitations of the resources they have. To keep producing intelligence, GCNCS needs more people, more places to house and feed them, and for them to work. And the billeting and catering and transport situations are all getting worse as more and more staff arrive. The operation gets bigger and bigger. By this point in the war, you're looking at about 1,000 people working here. But actually, that said, even though the organisation's got a lot bigger, recruitment is actually one of the biggest problems as well, finding the right people and tempting them to work here and being allowed to employ them here.
And was it this issue with recruitment that led these Codebreakers to write this now quite notorious letter to Churchill?
Yeah, so this is an event which is sort of seen as a turning point for Bletchley Park's fortunes, where a lot of these problems which are coming about start to get solved. You have four of your leading cryptanalysts at Bletchley: Gordon Welshman, in charge of Hut 6, his deputy Stuart Milner Barry, the chess champion, another chess champion in Hugh Alexander, working in Hut 8, and the head of that hut, Alan Turing. They are obviously at the cutting edge of Bletchley's work. They're very aware of how on a knife edge this all is and how the resource problems are holding them up and becoming increasingly frustrated with the situation.
But these four men are the sort of middle manager level, would you say? They're not the leaders at Bletchley Park.
They're not the leaders. In charge is Alistair Denniston. Alistair Denniston has been in charge from the start of the war. And there is the beginnings of a sort of administrative staff being built up. So you already have in place Alan Bradshaw, who is going to be the administrative chief for the rest of the war going forward. But the administrative side of things is something which isn't working incredibly well, as the Codebreakers are finding out. And that's why they make this decision to go over the heads of the management and straight to the Prime Minister. And one of the reasons they were prompted to do this was because Churchill had visited Bletchley Park on the 6th of September 1941. And this is another well-known part of the story. He comes into Hut 6, he has a talk with Gordon Welshman. He visits various sections around the park. He has a dramatic display in the Hollerith section of their tabulating machinery, more on which later. And at the end of the day, he stands in front of the mansion and gives a speech to the staff. There are various stories about this, whether Churchill's standing on a stone or a pile of rubble, but he gives a bit of an address to the staff in front of the mansion letting them know that he appreciates the work they're doing and to keep up the good work.
You were here when Churchill visited.
Oh, yes.
What can you remember about
that?
Well,
what I remember about that is that there was absolutely no publicity beforehand. In fact, it was probably the reverse of that. Anyway, I didn't know he was coming, nor did any other ordinary member of this place. And it was during my lunch break. I was then, I think, working in Block A. I would go for my lunch break, walking across, approaching this circular lawn from that direction. And as soon as I got inside the lawn, I noticed a group of, well, yes, young women clustered out here on the edge of the lawn. And as I came across it, I, to my astonishment, saw that they were listening to Churchill. I mean, the last thing I was expecting to encounter. And what had happened was he'd been visiting Hut 6 and Hut 8 and places like that earlier in the morning. A group of girls hadn't been spoken to by him. They were just juniors. He'd been dealing with the sort of the top cycle breakers and so on. And they had all said to each other, well, we're not all going to say goodbye to him. So they guessed he would leave before lunchtime. And they had spent their lunch break standing outside there in a group. Churchill came out of the front door. His car was parked just outside these windows, big Daimler, just outside these windows, with an ATS driver sitting in it, looking straight ahead, nowhere else. And he wasn't making an important speech. I mean, it was just an exhortation. Carry on the good work, you know, that kind of thing. And I just managed to catch the final words. And he then got down off the stone he was standing on the edge of the lawn there, straight into his car. And by the time his car reached the corner there, he was already reading documents from a big red box. I do know that he stood on the stone where that peasant one is. And my guess is, after an incident in the previous year, in 1940, he came in 1941, previous year, it was a sunny day in the summer of 40, and various people were standing around on this bit of grass, and a sports car suddenly shot across it. The young man got his foot jammed on the accelerator, rolled across, fortunately not hitting anybody or anything, but the management here immediately recognised the danger that, you know, there always were likely to be people hanging around out there on the grass on a nice day, and this might happen again. So I can't remember now how many days, but my memory is they seem to have reacted very quickly to have found a source of suitable stones to put round the grass, right round it, so no car could get onto it. And my guess is that they'd suddenly thought of, there's some dry stone walls in the rock garden. They knocked them down and got the big stones out of the bottom. Enough big stones, they say 30 or 40 stones, something like that. The gardeners got a wheelbarrow and they wheeled them and they put them around this. Within days, it couldn't happen again. It seemed to me that it'd be quite an idea to put a little memorial of this event in the form of a stone. So Judy and I, with the aid of the gardener here, were shown some possible stones which he had found in the...
Well, I think we looked at them while
in the lake.
Yes,
yes. Anyway, there were lots of stones in the bottom of the lake. And I think what happened at the end of the war, when the post office took over this place as a training establishment, they didn't want these great stones around the grass because it made it difficult to cut the grass up against a big stone. And the nearest place to dump them is in the lake.
That means the cryptanalysts are aware that Churchill has his eye on the operation.
Takes an interest.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And he did take an interest. Churchill was always interested in intelligence. He'd had experience. He'd been instrumental in this stuff, actually, in the First World War. Out of all the kind of major world leaders of the Second World War, he's probably the one who's most obsessed with how intelligence works. And he gets the output of Bletchley personally in his red box delivered to him every day so he can keep an eye on what's going on. Sometimes using it as a bit of a stick to beat his generals with. Maybe not the most perceptive interpreter of this intelligence, and it always can obviously never read everything. Mm-hmm. But he's very interested in the operation here.
And clearly appreciated its value as well.
Absolutely.
Prime Minister only. Hut 6 and Hut 8. 21st of October, 1941. Dear Prime Minister, some weeks ago you paid us the honour of a visit, and we believe that you regard our work as important. You will have seen that, thanks largely to the energy and foresight of Commander Travis, we have been well supplied with the bombs for the breaking of the German Enigma codes. We think, however, that you ought to know that this work is being held up, and in some cases is not being done at all, principally because we cannot get sufficient staff to deal with it. Our reason for writing to you direct is that for months we have done everything that we possibly can through the normal channels, and that we despair of any early improvement without your intervention. No doubt in the long run these particular requirements will be met, but meanwhile still more precious months will have been wasted, and as our needs are continually expanding, we see little hope of ever being adequately staffed. We realize that there is a tremendous demand for labor of all kinds, and that its allocation is a matter of priorities. The trouble, to our mind, is that as we are a very small section with numerically trivial requirements, it is very difficult to bring home to the authorities finally responsible either the importance of what is done here or the urgent necessity of dealing promptly with our requests. At the same time, we find it hard to believe that it is really impossible to produce quickly the additional staff that we need, even if this meant interfering with the normal machinery of allocations. We do not wish to burden you with a detailed list of our difficulties, but the following are the bottlenecks which are causing us the most acute anxiety.
So the cryptanalysts decide on this approach direct to Churchill. They write a letter. According to Milner Barry, it's Welshman who comes up with the idea of going to the PM and actually writes up the letter. But actually, it's Milner Barry who delivers it. He delivers it personally down to Downing Street. It has this quite surreal story of getting in a cab and saying to the cab driver, 10 Downing Street, who doesn't bat an eyelid, and take him straight there.
And this is the 21st of October 1941.
It's on the 21st of October 1941, Trafalgar Day, the significance of which they hope Churchill would appreciate.
Why I was deputed to carry the letter to number 10, I do not remember. At a guess, because I was the most readily expendable from the scene of action. What I do recall is arriving at Euston Station, hailing a taxi, and, with a sense of total incredulity, can this really be happening, invited the driver to take me to 10 Downing Street. The taxi driver never blinked an eyelid. Without comment, he directed himself to Whitehall and arrived at the entrance to Downing Street. I was again surprised by the lack of formality. There was just a wooden barrier across the road, and one uniformed policeman who waved my driver on. At the door of number 10, I paid off the taxi, rang the bell, was courteously ushered in, explained that I had an urgent letter which I was anxious to deliver to the Prime Minister personally, and was invited to wait. Of course, I did not see the Prime Minister himself, but very shortly there appeared a dapper, dark-suited figure of shortish stature, whom I subsequently identified as Brigadier Harvey Watt, Mr. Churchill's PPS. To him I again explained my errand, and while obviously and understandably puzzled as to who I might be, and what this was all about, he took me sufficiently seriously to promise that he would, without fail, deliver the letter to the Prime Minister and stress its urgency. That accomplished, I took my leave and took myself back to Bletchley by the next train. Years after, when I became a Whitehall bureaucrat, conditioned to going through the proper channels, I looked back from time to time on that journey and wondered whether it could really have been made by the same man. The thought of going straight from the bottom to the top would have filled my later self with horror and incredulity.
Extract from a post-war account by Stuart Milner Barry, published in the Intelligence and National Security Journal.
So we know Churchill received the letter. Did this solve all their problems?
When Churchill receives the letter, or actually the day after he receives it, he writes an order, which is the one we have on display in our visitor centre, which is headed with the famous line, "Action this day," and continues, "Make sure they have all they want on extreme priority and report to me that this has been done." And he gets that to General Ismay, who is his main sort of military advisor, and problem solved.
Mm.
So the story goes.
Clearly.
You know, Churchill's got involved. Bletchley Park has the recognition it needs, gets the resources it needs, and everything that goes on later in the war stems from this moment. Except it's not quite as simple as that, I don't think. I think we can argue that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's been mythologized, but that's not to say this story's not true.
It's based on
It's part of the picture. Definitely the facts that we've just laid out are accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot more going on behind the scenes. There's a lot more complexity to the situation than we often get from many of the books.
Why is this myth so compelling? Is it the Churchill connection?
Definitely part of it is the Churchill connection. And often Bletchley Park is sort of described as Churchill's almost sort of intelligence playground or something. It's never quite like that, however much he's interested. But that's definitely a big part of it. It's also a nice demonstration of the characteristics the codebreakers are meant to embody in terms of being willing to improvise, being free of all those constraints of bureaucracy,
sort of down the
and
rules
of the, and... you know, of the normal way of doing things, which would hold other people back, maybe hold the Germans back. And it's an example of their willingness to break the rules. It helps not just with the code breaking, but also with the organisational problems they're experiencing. But I think there are parts of this mythology we can sort of criticise in a gentle way. It feeds a myth that the code breakers were their own bosses, that they controlled their own affairs, and they could make whatever decisions they wanted, run their operations exactly as they wanted, with the support of Churchill, his sort of patronage, and the others in charge of Britain's war effort. So as soon as they got involved, Bletchley Park could do whatever it wants and go and win the war.
And you've said there's 1,000 people here at this point as well. So this impression that they're this sort of small group of mavericks running the organisation.
Yeah, so this story, again, is all about the cryptanalysts. It sort of forgets that that class of administrators and managers actually exist, because they are in the background beavering away, trying to solve all these problems at exactly that time. And it's about personalities. It's about maybe a clash of personalities between the codebreakers, Churchill and Denniston. Denniston doesn't come out of this situation well, and this is seen as a big blow to his prestige and the level of trust his superiors have in him to run this operation.
It's seen at the time, or now it's seen as a blow to his prestige?
It's hard to know at the time what impact it has, and as I say, there's a lot more going on. Clearly it's seen as a snub, mm-hmm. and Denniston is supposed to have met Milner Barry in the corridor in passing a few days after and said he doesn't hold any grudge over it. But clearly he sees it as a snub. Mm-hmm. The way the letter is phrased, sort of heaping praise on Edward Travis and not mentioning Denniston, is a tactful way of saying we don't fully believe in Denniston's powers of leadership anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see Denniston being moved sort of sideways to another part of the organisation. As you say, Bletchley Park has 1,000 people. It's bigger than individual personalities at this point. I think when we focus on the personalities, it makes for very compelling stories. I think that's why the Imitation Game film was so popular, despite, I think, you know, it's fair to say, a fair few inaccuracies. But there were big impersonal factors at play in this process. And I think all of the context around it makes it look like this order from Churchill and the whole episode with the letter. It looks like one of many events in Bletchley Park's constant struggle to sort of grow and get the resources it needs to run its operations. And what also becomes clear from the records is that the problems were not fixed overnight when Churchill got involved. They were having problems that they were having to fix right up to the end of the war.
We have written this letter entirely on our own initiative. We do not know who or what is responsible for our difficulties, and most emphatically, we do not want to be taken as criticizing Commander Travis, who has all along done his utmost to help us in every possible way. But if we are to do our job as well as it could and should be done, it is absolutely vital that our wants, small as they are, should be promptly attended to. We have felt that we should be failing in our duty if we did not draw your attention to the facts and to the effects which they are having and must continue to have on our work, unless immediate action is taken. We are, sir, your obedient servants. A. M. Turing, W. G. Welchman, C. H. O. D. Alexander, P. S. Milner Barry.
You said at the start that recruitment, or the lack of it, or the difficulties of it, prompted this letter. Can you tell us more about that? Was it Bletchley Park's biggest problem at the time?
I think it probably was. It's the one that definitely looms largest in the documentation that I've looked at. We've talked in previous episodes about how they recruited before the war and around the start of the war in the early days episode. It was a method of recruitment very much based on personal connections, the sort of old boys network or old girls network in some cases, family, friends, people who knew each other, you know, the connections in the upper echelons of British society through the universities, mostly. And that's a really good way of getting the right people into the organisation, even though it maybe looks very archaic to us. It's very successful because they know that somebody coming in has the skills they need and is going to be able to fit into the culture as well, which is very important, and work effectively with their colleagues. By 1941, the demands of national manpower policy are beginning to take a bigger place in the British war effort. During the war, the Ministry of Labour is the ministry responsible, and it has an office called the Central Register, which takes details of skilled people scientists, mathematicians, language experts, so a lot of the sort of people Bletchley Park are looking for, and directs them into the place they best fit into the British war effort. And they're doing the service for GCNCS, but the problem is they have a very poor understanding of what codebreaking involves, and the codebreakers are not able to tell them all the details because it's secret.
Right.
Most of the candidates who come from the Ministry of Labour seem to be rejected. They tend to think that if somebody is good at languages, they'll be a good fit at Bletchley, but it takes a lot more. It takes, you know, this ability for lateral thinking, creativity, and pure hard work. These things are all just as important as languages. What's also interesting is that these people who come into contact with Bletchley from outside get an idea of what the organisation is like culturally. They start to assume that everyone working at Bletchley is a bit eccentric, and then Bletchley have to go back to them and say, please don't send us people just because they're eccentric. And so we see the modern idea of Bletchley comes about during the war, even during the period when it's completely secret, which I find fascinating.
I had the time of my life here. I enjoyed myself very, very much. Bletchley was like its own town. There was an incredible amount of social life going on here. There was a thriving theatre whose director was a captain in the army called Captain Malcolm Howgate, and he was always known as Milky. Cowangate. Anyway, one of my great friends was lucky enough to be accepted at an audition for a play they did there called Yes, My Darling Daughter. And the leading lady in that was a Belgian ATS sergeant called Jeanne Kamerz, whose father, subsequently after the war, I discovered, was quite a famous film producer. There were all sorts of weird people here, you know. Interesting weird people, too. The novelist Agnes Wilson, he was here with his partner, Bentley Bridgewater, and they were the nuts. But no, it was great fun. It really was. I made a lot of good friends here.
So that is a system which doesn't treat Bletchley Park very well. But they are probably getting enough of those highly educated sort of cryptanalyst class of worker. What they struggle more with is your everyday sort of clerical worker, mostly female. You need people to, you know, do the typing, do the secretarial work, run your machines, run your communications. That's where they have real trouble.
Would that have been termed unskilled labour, or, I mean, typing is a skill?
I hesitate to say unskilled because it's not easy work. Mm-hmm. Again, you need to work for long hours and you need to concentrate and you need to not make mistakes, and that's all important. But it's labour that doesn't require existing qualifications, maybe we can put it that way. And early on, that demand is filled from the local population. Although quite early in the war, we also see service women starting to appear at Bletchley, but not in huge numbers. The first service women here are actually some women of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, the WAF, who come in late 1939 because they know how to operate teleprinters. It's their communications expertise that they look for from the RAF. From 1940, you've got ATS, Auxiliary Territorial Service women in the military section working on army codes. And then in 1941, you have the WRENS, the Women's Royal Naval Service, who come in to run the bombs.
You said we don't want to use the term unskilled labour, but this workforce that doesn't necessarily require qualifications, you said came from the local population. Do you mean the women of the local population?
Generally, yes.
Right. Or girls, I suppose, as well, school leaders.
They would have, they called them girls a lot at the time. Yeah, they were fairly young women. They considered older women unsuitable for the hours that they were working, you know, unable to put up with the stress and the strains of the work. Mm-hmm. So they wanted young women. The problem is, across the country, everybody else needs young women as well. The men have mostly been conscripted into the armed forces. The big source of labour is young mobile women, unmarried, as is important for the time. And ironically, that means Bletchley Park is also competing with the armed forces, the women's services, with industry, agriculture and the government. They're all going for the same pool of labour. And that pool is far from inexhaustible.
And I suppose when you can't explain what it is that you're wanting people to do in very much detail, it's not a very appealing job to go to as well.
Yeah, that's a big problem. For much of this period, Bletchley Park, GCNCS, looks like a normal government department, and therefore it's losing out. In 1941, the government starts to bring in policies which edge towards conscription for women, which is unprecedented. From April 1941, women aged 21 who were unmarried are required to register at the Labour Exchange, and they could be directed into work in the war industries, or they were given the women's services as a voluntary alternative. And it's no coincidence this comes just as Bletchley Park's manpower or woman power problem becomes really serious, because it reflects that national shortage of labour. And Bletchley Park loses out on that process because to the recruiters, it's a standard government department and it is not afforded any higher priority than any other government department.
Because they'd just be filing for the civil service, basically.
Yeah. So war industry is naturally, you know, the focus for recruitment.
One of the things I was thinking, this might not be relevant because it is a bit later, some of those memos we've been looking at. I mean, the advertising for like school leavers, they're going into schools and looking at girls of like 15.
Yeah, but I don't think they do that very much.
Right.
Because it's hard to employ people like that. They have higher welfare requirements, obviously, and those are laid down and they have to follow those.
Yeah.
They have to make sure they're properly housed and looked after. Mm-hmm. It's easier just to recruit adults. We might make the assumption that GC&CS starts off being quite discerning with its recruitment and has to become less discerning later on and sort of recruit on a wider basis. But actually the opposite is true with this local labour. There's a big difference between the tasks of your average worker and your sort of supervisor, managerial person. And so the organisation is able to fill its spaces for the really unskilled staff and the completely unqualified staff quite easily. The sort of people they refer to as stooges or slaves.
How lovely.
In the language of the time.
Hmm.
I don't think they quite have the connotations they do now. They're able to find those sorts of people. What they need is more skilled staff who they can delegate a bit of responsibility to, who can be expected to understand a task and be left to get on with it and maybe manage a few of their colleagues without someone really highly skilled having to supervise it. That's the case in the tabulating section or the hollerer section, which I mentioned earlier.
And those were people like message carriers or people lugging documents from building to building.
Yeah, and also people doing jobs which are very simple and they could be trained quickly to do without any pre-existing experience.
Can you just tell me how you first came here?
Yes, my mother knew Captain Bradshaw and I think my mother must have been talking to him about me because he said, bring her up, because I wasn't learning anything at school. I was in a temporary hut as a school in Bletchley because we evacuated here. And he asked me one or two questions, what were my hobbies and did I enjoy reading? And I must have answered the right questions for him. I was interviewed in here in the house, in one of the corridors near the kitchen. I know the feel of the ground. This is from being a messenger, because I tramped for 2 years with all the messages around the park, and I knew where the soft parts were and the more difficult parts, and I knew exactly how the ground felt. I can still feel it when I come in. I have taken people over the house, because being a messenger, you had to know where everybody was, because you had to take things everywhere. All of the important parts had names to them, you see. We used to have at least 4 or 5 deliveries that we had to make a day. And my department, when I was so young, used to close at about 6 o'clock, I think, because I wasn't allowed to work beyond certain hours because of my age.
So you were the baby of the park, really?
Well, one of them. Were, I think there were about 5 of us. And most of, I think, were probably older than me. My mother and my older sister worked here as well. And my sister worked in Hut 10 for Josh Cooper. And I never, ever knew what she did. And I had to go over there sometimes with messages. But, of course, we didn't speak in the office until the day I turned up for work in her clothes. I felt I had nothing decent to wear at home. I put on a new blouse and skirt of hers, never thinking I would be sent to Hut 10 to deliver a message to one of the WAF officers there. I walked into the room and my sister was sitting there. I crept past her desk and I just handed her what I had to give her, turned round, and as I walked, I had to pass my sister's desk. As I walked past, I saw her eyes more than her head turn and say, "You wait until I get you home." And I didn't know what to do. And I'd split her blouse here on the seams.
And did you get it when you got home?
Well, there was a big row. And my mother said, "You're not going to touch her," you know. And that's how secretive everything was. I was an embarrassment to her here anyway. And she said, "I don't ever tell anybody you're my sister." She was ashamed.
Can you tell us more about this tabulating section?
Yes. This is a concept which is quite alien to people nowadays, and to me, actually, before I started looking into it. The cutting-edge 1940s, you know, information technology is these tabulating machines, and they use punch cards. You can use punch cards to store a certain amount of information. They actually have 80 columns on the card, So you can store 80 characters of information, either letters or numbers, and it's represented by holes in the cards.
So they're printed and you punch a hole in a particular place on the card.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can do things with these cards. You can use them to crunch data in various ways. You can sort data, you can put it in alphabetical order, you can give a machine a data set and ask it to pick out certain things. This is also easy for us to do nowadays with digital technology. That it seems very alien. The amount of machinery you would need to do all this, the amount of actual cards, the amount of people. But this is something most big businesses and certainly government in the 1940s would be doing on quite a large scale. It's actually nothing new because this machinery was actually developed in the 1880s. It was first used in the 1889 US Census. And it's used for things like big businesses putting together their payroll, tasks of that sort.
And it did continue as well. I mean, some of our listeners will be familiar with it. I recently discovered my mother used these machines, I think in the 1960s, for administration sorting, payroll and things. So it won't be alien to everybody, but those who haven't come across it, it is bonkers.
It's that technological bridge between sort of pure pen and paper administration and computerization. And it comes very close to computerization.
And I think people will be surprised that this was happening at Bletchley Park, these machines. And it wasn't just a couple of them, as you say, there were plenty of machines working all the time at Bletchley.
Yeah, there were probably about 50 machines. They start off in a hut. The hut gets bigger and bigger. They have to keep expanding it for more machines. They can't get all the machines out of their packing cases and actually put them out on the floor. So eventually one of the earliest blocks that opens is Block C, which is now our visitor centre, and that's designed for these Hollerith machines to be housed in. And it's a big operation. They're using about 2 million cards a week on average, up to about 3 million cards. So that's tons of them coming through. Where you enter Bletchley Park now is the loading bay for those cards, and they would be bringing lorries in and unloading them directly into the building, and then they would go away to be punched with information and for it to be processed in various ways.
So tell us about 1941 and this section. You said local women were being employed to do this card punching and working with these machines.
The biggest job in the section is punching all the cards from scratch. And you do that with a hand punch which has a keyboard on it. It's a one-handed keyboard, and you slot the card in, punch the data in, and the card comes out. And sometimes those are purely mechanical, sometimes electronic. But that's menial, relatively unskilled work that just requires lots of workers. And we have these photos of the spur in Block C where this went on with just rows of desks.
Women with their heads
punches,
down.
Women with their heads down, just punching away, yeah. Typing away. So Freeborn can do that work. What he needs is people who have a bit more initiative about them. He says he doesn't just want people who've left school religiously at the age of 14. He needs people who can be left to their own devices. Understand a bit of the broader processes, because once you punch the cards, you have to put them through the machines in a certain way to carry out the analytical task you're interested in. And so you need a bit of an understanding of the process.
Would these relatively young, unskilled people, would they know what they were doing? Would they have the context of, as you say, these analytical tasks, these kind of code-breaking tasks that they're doing?
They would certainly in the beginning know virtually nothing, and they would be told nothing about why they were doing it. Some of them have an aptitude for the work and sort of graduate to more responsible jobs. Some of them don't. Some of them just do this for 4 or 5 years and never quite know why.
And probably hated it as well.
And it must have been very, very dull. The Hollerith section is run by a chap called Freddie Freeborn. He's from the British Tabulating Machine Company, who have the monopoly on these sorts of machines in the UK. And he is one of the, certainly the national expert on how to use these machines. So he's an expert in how he can carry out all those analytical tasks which the code breakers need. And he brings with him a team from BTM who act as the supervisors of the section.
You've called these machines Hollerith machines as well. Was Hollerith part of BTM?
The machines were invented by Herman Hollerith originally. His company becomes International Business Machines, IBM, and BTM owned the IBM concession in the UK at the start of the war. So the section is after Freeborn. It's often called the Freebornery in BP parlance. The problem is Freeborn, because he runs the machine section, and this is how the recruiters understand it, he's mostly being sent women who are qualified for basic sort of factory-type machine work. It's sort of indistinguishable from someone working on a lathe in a munitions factory. But he's got too many people like that. He needs people who are a step up and who can start to take responsibility. But that's not something the local labour market is able to provide. There's very few big businesses in the area, very few people with any experience of this tabulator machine work.
I would imagine travelling long distances is not easy. There's a war on and so on.
Yeah, actually tempting people to move into the area is really difficult. A big part of that is GCNCS can't give decent wages. There are other departments or other industries out there that will pay women much better rates of pay for much easier work in many cases. So they just can't compete. Mm. And the Ministry of Labour also has an obligation that they seem to take very seriously, that when they direct labour, they must ensure that it goes directly towards something which is essential for the war effort. If they're taking workers out for business, they need to ensure that business that it's important. And for the workers as well, they need to be told that the work is essential. That's not a guarantee that Bletchley Park can provide mm-hmm. because of the demand for secrecy. So they're losing out in the competition for the sort of labour which they really need.
So I'm not surprised that recruitment was a major issue for them. How does this relate to Bletchley Park's impact on the war effort?
As I said before, Bletchley Park has actually been really successful in its code-breaking. The British Army is fighting in North Africa. That's its main theatre of conflict. And Hut 6, the Army Air Enigma decryption section, has broken the light blue Enigma key back in February. If you visit our restored wartime huts, we have them set dressed and we have sound effects to evoke the atmosphere of the very day in February 1941 that they break the light blue.
With associated cheering sound effects of hurrah, we've broken
absolutely.
The light blue.
People standing on tables, stamping their feet, because it was a big achievement. That's because the light blue is the liaison key between the German army and air force in North Africa. We've talked in previous episodes countless times about the Flevo keys, and this is an early example of how crucial those are. As they know very well from previous experience, those liaison communications are a really good source of information about what army units are doing as well as air force ones. So it's fantastic news. The other achievement Hut 6 makes is to break a key called Chaffinch. That comes in September of that year. And that is the actual army key used by Rommel's Africa Corps.
Key being Enigma key?
Enigma key. And used for communications between its different military units and with headquarters back in Rome. So again, lots of really valuable information coming in from Hut 6. But the biggest success of 1941 has been with Naval Enigma. It's been something which certain people, most of all Turing, have had their eye on from the start of the war. And after 18 months' work, they finally started to break Naval Enigma on a continuous basis from the middle of 1941. And that's come as a result of these pinches, these seizures of cipher material. They seized a German trawler in part of a raid on the Lofoten Islands in Norway in March and captured a U-boat, U-110, in May. And they also arranged the capture of two weather ships in June. And all of the material that's gathered has given Hut 8, which is the section responsible for this work, the leg up they need to start breaking Naval Enigma. Specifically, we're talking about the home waters key that they codenamed Dolphin.
So May 1941 and U-110, that's your real link to Bletchley Park, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you lead us up to what happened? So you were on a convoy.
Ships are getting sunk, all right. Then they ping, ping, ping through. And they got a contact with a submarine, all right.
And where was this? In the North Atlantic?
Oh, yeah, North Atlantic, yeah. About 100 miles or something, or 500, something like that. And they got this here, contact with a submarine. And I think it come up from about, where is it, from here? A bit far than that tree. The submarine, you can see it coming up.
All right, so it wasn't that far.
No, it wasn't that
quite
far.
Quite close.
And the guns couldn't get...
Couldn't so drop down enough.
The bloke, as we was in the whale, there was a bloke firing over your head. He had a strip Lewis gun.
So the submarine comes up and the captain asks for a boarding party, does he?
He didn't ask, did he say you?
Well, orders a boarding party. So how many were there of you?
In the ship, because it's a guns crew, I think there must have been 5 to 7 blokes in the guns crew, captain the gun and doers. And it comes through on the earphones, ex-gun man the whaler. So we had dropovers, ain't? Yep. So only one bloke didn't go. He was the captain of the gun. He was in charge of the gun. He never came on there. So we all scrambled down onto the whaler. I think there must have been 20 or 25 people to lower it. You've got to move it out like that. You've got to keep control over it. And if you get 5 of us sitting in there, going to be more weight. There's only 2 ropes holding it. So clear lower deck for lowering the whaler, all right? So all the seamen are... weren't doing any special job, get on the iron deck. So all these chaps have to manhandle these. Then it's man the oars. Then there's me and the other blokes rowing away to the U-boat.
So at this point, the U-boat surfaced, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's damaged.
Yeah.
And are the crew jumping out?
They're jumping out, some are jumping out, some are there. But they were all jumped out on the lee side of the submarine here. They all jumped over that side, not side, because they're going to get shot otherwise.
The opposite side to
Yeah, because they're going to get shot to pieces, because a lot of them got killed, see? So they all jumped out there. And as we come up like this here, we had to get on board. Someone scrambled on board there. And then as there was messing about on the submarine, like we, all of us, this here boat, nobody in it. And the waves coming along there and bashed it and bashed it and bashed it, sunk, smashed the whaler. And so no transport, see?
Before they told you to board, did you have any idea what you were going to do?
Nothing, just go on there and take it over. We were going to get on board and just take it as a salvage or tow it into harbour. So we were getting a few bits and pieces and that together. And where that's gone, your transport's gone. Yeah. I said, how much is that? Can you swim? I said, now's your chance to learn them. So I think that they had another contact with another submarine. The Bulldog cleared off. We was on a Jack Jones on there. We've got another submarine up, it's on a torpedo us. So we all got in there getting bits and pieces and getting bags.
So when you went in the first time, who led the boarding party?
Lieutenant
Baum.
Baum, that's about that.
David Baum.
Yeah, David Baum, yeah.
So did who lead the boarding party in?
He was in charge of us.
Yeah. So did he say anything to you what to look for?
No,
did he just say grab anything?
Just everything we got. Just fill your bags up. We've got all the stuff there, but no transport, all right. There's another destroyer, and they allowed their boat, and they did the transporting. When we got all the gear, they did all the moving from the submarine to the Bulldog. When all the gear was on the Bulldog, it had bags like...
canvas sacks, were they?
Yeah. They got on the mess deck. And the blokes were sitting on the mess deck, so most of them tipped all the stuff on the mess deck table. Yeah, help yourself. And the blokes said, well, I love that. And it all sort of just went, still be in the country somewhere. I've even got tin out here as well. Got the lamp here, got sword here, got hat here.
What, all from U110?
Yes. Clocks and things and watches and medals and all in the country somewhere. Nobody's asked for them.
When you were inside the U-boat, it was literally anything you could pick up, you put in a bag.
False teeth or whatever.
So you weren't just looking for...
No, just that would come in handy, that would come, like the tin out, you know, yeah. Put it in there. A lot of little knickknacks, you know, watches or...
So do you know who pinched the Enigma?
That bloke,
David Baum. Yeah. Commander Baum.
He's a bloke. He was a bloke of more intelligent, that's
sub-lieutenant, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's a more intelligent role.
So if we go back to when you were at sea, so the initial idea was to tow the U-boat to port, wasn't it?
We towed it for about 3 days with a rope. I think it was a rope, it wouldn't be a cable, because there was a bloke there with a hacksaw ready to chop the wire in case it was sinking.
And, yeah, start dragging the boat.
Yeah, and it would have us as well, more or less. In the end, towed it for 3 days because we were going to tie it into Iceland.
Mm.
Towed it to Iceland, but 3 days it sunk because they were going to salvage it, it was. And from there, it's another job, another convoy.
Yeah. So the German
crew...
Well,
we had a prisoner on board. After we got everything sorted out and the prisoners couldn't see what was happening, we had half the German survivors on the mess deck, giving them whatever it was, a cup of tea.
Were they put on the lee side of the ship to the U-boat?
Well, no, they were boxed off, they couldn't see them.
So they were actually boxed off so they couldn't see anything?
Yeah, like put them in there and close the doors.
Right.
Because we got guards on them. We used to let them out on the upper deck after we'd lost the U-boat.
Yeah.
And we were going to take them into Scotland.
While you were towing it, were they kept hidden the whole time?
Yes. Yeah. Till it sunk, then we let them have some fresh air on the upper deck.
There was lots of secrecy about it, wasn't there?
Yeah, because we didn't know what was doing, what was going on and what's it for.
So when you got to port, was that when you found out that you'd done something quite secret?
Not really, no.
Were you interviewed when you got to port?
We got aboard, yeah, but the trouble is we had the prisoners on board, took them into Scotland somewhere, and the army took them over. I think they blindfolded them as well. So they couldn't see. Anyway, we turned them over to the army. So that was that. Then after a while, these here bods from London have come and interviewed you. What do you see and all that? And they put down a bit of paper and that's somewhere else up in London somewhere.
So was that just the boarding party?
Yeah, just the boarding party, yeah.
So were you separated from the rest of the crew?
No. Just part of the gang.
Yeah, they didn't sort of make it a big deal
you've
done something.
Another job, you've just been down to get the milk, you know.
So were you told not to talk about it?
We're told not to say we've been, yeah, that's it, yeah. Because not until I got mentioned in dispatches, and that's the only time the wife knew.
then, as you say, it was just back onto another convoy.
Yeah, another job. Yeah, another job.
One of the most important techniques for breaking naval enigma is called Bamburismus. It's called Bamburismus because it involves what are called Banbury sheets. They are produced in Banbury and brought to BP, and they give the name to the technique. And the basic idea is if you can put German enigma messages in depth, that means they've been enciphered at the same position of the machine, you can carry out analysis which can help you break the key. The way you work out messages are in depth is by spotting repeated characters. If you think about what the chance of a repeated character in random ciphertext is, it would be 1 in 26.
Yes.
Because there's 26 letters of the alphabet. If you have messages set in depth, the repeat rate won't be 1 in 26. It would depend on the encrypted German letters, but it will start to vary. You will start to see encrypted E's more than you'll see W's, for example, because German, just like English, has letters that come up more commonly. What you can do once you've got messages in depth is then carry out analysis, which allows you to spot whether there's been a turnover of the middle rotor of the Enigma machine.
How on earth would you spot a turnover of the middle rotor?
The right-hand rotor always moves.
With every press of the keyboard?
Right. The middle rotor doesn't always move. The middle rotor moves sometime within the right-hand rotor making a full rotation. So sometimes it stays still. If you can set your messages in depth, and you do this by forming chains between letters, it's rather complex and it's quite a skillful job. Hugh Alexander is meant to be the best Bamburist because it's quite a creative task as well. And if you have an analytical mind, well, you can go away and read all the detail about this. But the short answer is you can identify where there hasn't been a turnover of the rotor. And therefore, you can say, well, you know where the turnover positions of the rotors are. If a rotor turnover hasn't happened, it allows you to rule out rotors which would have turned over at that position.
So if you know where they aren't, you can work out where they are.
Exactly. According to the history of Hut 8, this could reduce your rotor orders for testing from about 270, which is the rotor orders the German Navy actually uses in practice, to about 90, but sometimes as low as 3.
Wow.
So that means the information you give to your bomb machines is a lot more targeted. You can do the right tests. You can use less bomb time. And it allows you to do the whole process much quicker. And as I said, one way to find these messages which are in depth is to get your Banbury sheets, punch holes in them with the message text, and slide them against each other and see where the holes line up. But actually, another way of doing this process is using Holerif. It's a really good example of the sort of analytical task you can carry out using your Holerif machinery.
Mm-hmm.
So allow me to run through how this works
from
start to finish. You take all the Naval Enigma ciphertext you've intercepted for a whole day, about 80,000 individual characters, and you divide this into 25 letter groups and you punch those all on Holerif cards.
Which I'm saying must have been a very boring job punching gobbledygook into cards.
Yeah, it would have been very boring. This is why you need those tables with rows of women sitting
Absolutely.
At them, because you need to do this every single day. The reason for 25 letters seems to be that's the most you can practically fit on a card with all the other information. You need a group earlier on the card for the number of the message and that sort of information. So a 25-letter group is a nice number to work with. Once you've got all your 25-letter groups on cards, those are your master cards.
Of all the 80,000 enciphered letters that you're going to be putting
on. So you've got the entire naval ciphertext on a series of cards in 25-letter groups, and they're fed into a machine called the reproducer. And with each master card, there are 24 blank cards put behind it. And what the reproducer does, it's quite clever. It copies that 25-letter group onto the next card, but offset by one place. And then it copies it again onto the next card, offset by one place. And you can see as you go through, this is the reason you've got 24 cards. You can offset it by one place going all the way through the system and then move on to the next master card. In the end, you've got a 25-letter group on each card, and you've got a different card for each letter of the ciphertext. So you've got 80,000 cards. Each have a section of the ciphertext offset by one place going all the way through. A separate card for every letter of the message. You've got 80,000 cards. Actually, the number of processes, whether punching a card or running it through a machine, you have to do for this job is 727,000 every day. You can see why they had to automate this. You couldn't do this in an office with pen and paper.
Absolutely. So you've got your stack of 80,000 cards. What do you do with them? Why do you have them?
What you do next is you put them in alphabetical order, which is quite straightforward. You have a series of sorting machines to make the task quicker. You would split the job between different machines and then amalgamate the result at the end. But you just put them in alphabetical order. And you can see that if you're going to get a repeated string of characters in the ciphertext, they're all going to be next to each other after that. And then you put them into another machine called the collator. Normally it's used to get different stacks of cards and put them together, but it can be used to select cards from a deck depending on the characteristics. And you ask it to select all pairs of cards for which the first four letters are identical. The four-letter string is called a tetragram. And if you have a four-letter string in messages which have similar indicators at the start, you're onto a good bet that they are set in depth.
Yeah, you've got your same message that you're dealing with here twice. You say you ask the machines to do it nicely. It's a series of cables and plugs, basically. You set a machine in a certain way. That's how you ask it to do it. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, they would have plug boards on, a bit like that on the Enigma, actually, if you're familiar with that. And that would program them in various ways. And that would all have to be done. This is why the people who are able to do that sort of job and save the supervisors the hassle of doing it are worth their weight in gold for Freeborn. Once the collator's done its job, you've got a stack of cards which have no particular similarity. Those can go into the incinerator or back to the paper mill to get pulped into your next batch of cards. And you have a stack of cards with repeated ciphertexts on them. Then you put them in a machine called the tabulator, which is the main machine, which gives you your result. And it simply prints out a list of all of these repeats. That goes off to Hut 8, and the cryptanalysts can do the rest of the process. It's so complicated, and there are so many steps in it. And this is all to achieve a reduction in the wheel orders that need to be tested on the bomb, which itself is an extremely complex process in its own right. So it boggles the mind after a while. It really does.
But there is this human element to it as well. There are people carrying these cards, removing some of these cards, moving to the next machine, or at least passing them along to someone working at the next machine. And as you say, people in Hut 8 as well. So it isn't a fully automated process. There has to be this level of understanding as well.
Yeah, one way to see the Hollow of Section is a bit like a computer with mechanical parts and organic parts. And the machines do one particular job or just a few jobs. And between them are people who arrange the workflow. And it was not unknown for the head of the section to actually draw chalk lines on the floor between the machines to tell his workers where to carry the cards between the machines. Because in doing that, he could sort of program the entire building towards a particular function. So that's why it's a fascinating bridge between old technology and new technology, leading towards computerization.
You're clearly really interested in this. We haven't really covered things like, we mention Hollerith from time to time, from episode to episode, and in our exhibitions as well on site. But it's not really something we go into a lot of detail about.
I think it's part of the story that doesn't get enough attention. The way that current technology was turned to the code-breaking task, as well as these new machines like the bomb and Colossus, is not talked about enough. And it's so important for making Bletchley Park work. I mean, Hugh Alexander says about this process in support of Bamburismus, this Tetra catalogue, providing as it did our good fits, was the foundation of our work, and the speedy and efficient service we received played a major part in our success. Yet if you read some of the best books on Naval Enigma, you will barely see any mention of Hollerith, if any. And I think that's very unfair on Freeborn and his team and all of the women who worked under him. They are sort of unsung heroes and they deserve a lot of credit for what they did.
And I can see why you're not keen on describing it as unskilled labour, particularly when there's been a focus on what must seem like strikes of genius, which help break these impossible ciphers, when a lot of it is very necessary, sort of grunt work almost.
Yeah. What I love about this as well is that it is something the average person can definitely get their head around. It's not on the same level as the bomb or Colossus. You don't need to be a genius to understand it. You just need to think, how do I make that process simpler with the machinery I've got?
As you said, there were people who were punching holes in cards. There were people who had to know how to repair the machines. There were people who had to know how to program the machines, how to manage the groups of people who were doing all of that as well. And as you say, program this sort of organizational machine of the Freebornery itself. So there were different levels of skill required, different levels of training and experience required.
And they're all equally important. Without any of them, the whole operation wouldn't have worked. It would have all fallen apart.
Before the war broke out, did you live locally?
Yes, at New Bradwell.
How old were you when the war broke out?
12.
You were 12, right. So you were at school?
Yes, in New Bradwell until I passed 11 plus, and then went up to the grammar school. And from the grammar school, I passed over to the science and art, the technical college at Wolverton, to do shorthand and typewriting and commercial arts.
When that came to an end, how old were you?
Well, 16.
You were 16. So what did you decide to do then?
Well, I did want to do typing. I passed my exams for that and shorthand and English. And my friend and I, we hadn't decided what we wanted to do or anything. And then one day, the headmistress called us both And she said, have you decided what you want to do when you finish here? And we said, well, no, as long as it's something with what we've trained for. And she said, well, I want you to, she said, if you will, go for an interview to Bletchley Park. And so we never applied for anything. It was just that we were asked to go, and we went to the interview, both of us, and, you know, spoke to them, then went back again. Yes, we accepted the work there.
Right.
I only feel that Bletchley Park must have, seeing that was the technical college for teaching, I think they must have asked, do you know, for two persons then.
Yes.
To go. And she herself had chosen us two to go there.
We can see that Hollerith is really important to the work that Bletchley Park was doing then. That must mean it was a huge problem that they couldn't get the staff for that department.
Yeah, if you can't use Hollerith, then you can't break Naval Enigma. You know, if you can't staff the Hollerith section, you know, the whole process breaks down. So the cryptographers are very aware that their greatest feat of the war so far is sort of hanging on a knife edge if they can't get enough people. And so Hugh Alexander decides to take action. Now, before the war, his background, as well as being a chess prodigy, he'd worked at John Lewis, at the John Lewis Partnership.
John Lewis, the department store.
The department store, exactly. Described as a sort of head of personnel in some sources, head of research in other places. Not quite sure what he did. It might simply have been that Mr. John Lewis was quite passionate about chess himself and liked having a chess champion on the team.
Did Gordon Welshman work at John Lewis as well?
After the war.
Ah, okay.
But as a result of Hugh Alexander giving him the reference, basically, yeah. Like most big businesses, John Lewis uses these Hollerith machines. It has operators in its offices in London. And so Alexander approaches them and is interested in recruiting some of these for Bletchley. He got the consent of the company to take them. And along with Miss Moore of the Foreign Office, they go and interview 50 women and they get the promise of 10 of them to come to Bletchley Park.
So they're basically poaching staff from John Lewis.
So they are doing this unashamed poaching recruitment via personal connections again.
Hmm.
But then they run into trouble from the Ministry of Labour, which doesn't let them take the women because Bletchley Park is not considered a justifiable place of employment to take them to.
Is this all documented, this sort of, no, you shan't have them?
Not quite so directly, but we can tell from the records of GCNCS, that from the correspondence that's going back and forth between the people trying to recruit these women, what's going on. And it brews up into this big sort of interdepartmental dispute about staffing for Bletchley. With big names involved, it's got much bigger than just this place. Denniston is backed up by Stuart Mingus of SIS and also by senior figures in the Foreign Office. So you've got Frank Ashton Gwatkin, who is the Foreign Office chief clerk, an interesting figure in his own right, actually a novelist, and he spent time in Japan, a bit of a Japanese expert. So he would maybe, if he'd been a few years younger, might have been a good candidate for Bletchley himself. And GCNCS also has support from the Treasury. The permanent secretary to the Treasury is a chap called Horace Wilson, who was Neville Chamberlain's right-hand man during the time of appeasement. He's not on good terms with Churchill, but he's still in government at this stage, and he's still an influential figure in Whitehall. And he gets involved and advocates for GCNCS. And the opposition in this dispute is from Frank Tribe, who is the deputy head of the Ministry of Labour, who appears in the correspondence. So all these people are arguing about how we deal with Bletchley. Eventually, Mingus and Denniston are successful in bringing enough pressure on Tribe to make him change his mind and allow them to have these women from John Lewis.
I presume they couldn't explain why. It was just this sort of influence that they were able to have.
Yeah, it's having to tiptoe around the issue is tricky. And obviously, the Ministry of Labour has so many competing demands from so many different quarters to get the attention they need. It takes quite a lot of effort. They do get there, but it takes a long time. Ashton Gwatkin actually writes a document in which he gives the whole story, and he calls it a sad story of delay and obstructionism. He's pretty scathing about the Ministry of Labour's approach to this whole thing. In the meantime, while all these discussions are going on at Whitehall, the Ministry of Labour sends a representative to Bletchley Park to assess the situation here. It's a Miss Bongard who is sent, but the visit doesn't go well. She's quite unhappy about not being able to see the work that's going on and the fact that the managers have to be very cagey about what happens here. They complain that this is in variance to the normal procedure where normally the Ministry of Labour is given pretty much unfettered access and given a very good idea of the sort of people who are required and how many of them. Obviously, that's not possible. And Denniston also feels she's more interested in telling him how to run his agency than actually helping, and writes a very interesting letter that lays out a lot of the difficulties that they're having.
18th of October, 1941. Dear Ashken Gwatkin, Miss Bongard of the Reading Divisional Office of the Ministry of Labour called today. Commander Bradshaw and Mr. Freeborn were present during the interview. I got the impression that Miss Bongard felt we might reorganise this office to meet the plans of the Ministry of Labour in the matter of distribution of female labour. We made it quite clear that the work of this office was considered of real national importance, meeting the needs of many departments, and that we had no intention of altering our methods except to improve our work, and that staff must be found to carry out these duties. It appears to me that the Ministry of Labour officials either have not heard of the priority, equal to that of the services, which Sir Horace Wilson had agreed we must have, or that they are not disposed to implement his instruction. The only promise Miss Bongard could make was that the local exchanges should be ordered to give us priority to obtain the type of labour we need. She was quite definite that we should not get the shop assistance from the retail stores in London, John Lewis. Such labour was, according to her, permitted to volunteer for the Wrens, ATS and WAFs, but not for us. Such labour was intended for the war ministries. Miss Bongard took notes of the numbers actually now required. In round numbers, I said we needed 100 to meet anticipated expansion. She said she would report to her chief, Mr. Blakiston, on Monday morning, October the 20th. I said that we were not prepared for further discussion, but wanted the staff and that I would report on these lines to my chiefs. I am persuaded that the Ministry of Labour knows of no difference between this office and other normal ministries such as the Ministers of Pensions, Shipping, Food, and so on. Yours, signed, A. G. Denniston.
On the 21st of October, 1941, Mingus meets with Tribe and they have yet another discussion about the points on which they disagree, and finally Mingus is able to persuade him to release the John Lewis ladies for recruitment. Only with assurances that, I quote, this was an entirely special case and on no account would the same privilege be asked for in any other government establishment. And the other thing Mingus does is threaten to go to the Prime Minister, and that seems to have been his ace in the hole, so to speak.
But hang on, the 21st of October 1941, that's a date that we've already heard before.
Yeah, it's the same day those cryptanalysts write their letter to Churchill. So I think this background gives us a better idea about the letter, actually, because I think we can see what's going on here. The idea of writing the letter, the actual wording, are attributable to Welshman. That might be true, but it seems an enormous coincidence that it was during that disagreement over the ladies from John Lewis, where Hugh Alexander had been interviewing them personally, that he then goes and puts his name to this letter. And the main problems described in the letter, first and foremost, is the shortage of staff in the Horace section. And the cryptanalysts say that this is causing the breaking of Naval Enigma to be delayed by 12 hours every day. It's only secondarily that they complain that they don't have enough staff to decode Army Air Enigma, and they need more people for bomb testing as well.
Do you think Hugh Alexander was just chancing his arm and going for two different options and thinking one might succeed? And actually, not only did they get this agreement to get the Hollerith women, they also went through with sending this letter to Churchill.
Well, I think he was simply frustrated that the official channels weren't working or not as fast as he wanted. Probably slightly frozen out of the discussions going on in Whitehall. And the cryptanalysts decided enough was enough, and that was the trigger. You know, they had a lot of other grievances at this stage, but that seems to have been the trigger for actually deciding to send the letter and go over Denniston's head. It's hard to know where the motivation came from and where the actual act of sending it and writing it came from. And I think it has a lot of the marks of Welshman as well, because he is known for writing these long memos, the sort of diatribes, and sending them off to people.
And who's to say Hugh Alexander didn't say, well, I've got this other iron in this fire, and they went, well, let's see what we can
do. Maybe Welshman thought that was the ammunition he could use. Mm. But I definitely think there's more to the story here than we usually read about. It's just unfortunate for Denniston, really, because his methods, and along with Mingus, to work through the problems in the sort of diplomatic way that you have to deal with other departments and with civil servants, do work, and they get the women. And they are just pipped to the post by the cryptanalyst's letter, and it steals Denniston's thunder and undermines confidence in him. And you wonder if things might have turned out differently if they managed to reach agreement with the Ministry of Labour maybe a week earlier. But it's really interesting how at this stage in 1941, things seem to be on a knife edge, and they could have gone in all sorts of different directions, depending on how that complex interaction of sort of the organisational aspects of cryptanalysis and the work at Bletchley and the resourcing of the organisation, they all sort of interact with each other.
But it does defy this idea that this letter was sent and Churchill said action this day, and action was taken as a result of that. And lo and behold, Bletchley Park began getting what it wanted and succeeding.
Yeah, that's the other thing, because they don't immediately start getting what they want. Denniston and Mingus keep having to go back to the Ministry of Labour. They have another meeting in November where they go over the same issues and have to sort of reiterate and say, no, we do have the Prime Minister's support here and you are going to have to let us recruit who we want. And in December 1941, there's another danger, which is when full conscription for women comes in. So they are able to conscript them into the women's services and they comb out workers from government departments, and GC&CS remains subject to those until further negotiations exempt them. But there is a danger they will lose staff and they will be conscripted straight into the armed forces. This is something that actually happens in a few cases with male staff. A very amusing story with Gordon Welshman, actually, trying to conscript him. He has to hide inside the wire at Bletchley for a few days until this is all sorted out. And then he has to go to a recruiting depot, get enlisted, and then honourably discharged again half an hour later. But jumping through the loops of the bureaucracy, Bletchley's never able to avoid that bureaucracy. It has to deal with it. And often it's easier than just ploughing their own furrow. They just jump through the hoops and just to keep people happy in recruitment, as in so many other cases.
It sounds so civil service as well, doesn't it? The dense bureaucracy, the long corridors. It sounds quite familiar as well. So nothing changes. But how frustrating not to be able to argue your case because you can't talk about what it is that you need or why you need it.
Yeah, it must have been enormously frustrating.
But GC&CS can't have been the only organisation facing this. There must have been SIS, there must have been other groups in military intelligence that were having similar struggles, surely.
SIS already had its independence and had its secret funds and could basically do what it wanted to a large extent. Military intelligence departments, obviously, they have the support of their military ministries. No doubt there are departments in various places across the country who have similar problems. I think GC&CS, it does suffer from a bit of a perfect storm of high demand for things which are in short supply and not being able to fight its case, and for a period at least lacking the allies it needed. This is probably the main thing which changes, as it has people like Churchill, like Ismay, like Miss Moore at the Foreign Office, and all those higher ups in civil service who do recognise how important Bletchley is and do make sure it has what it needs. So to that extent, the Action This Day story is not a bad illustration of how GC&CS overcomes the problems.
What about meals?
Don't talk about meals. It's not a nice subject at all. No, meals were a bit of a problem. They were all right at the Abbey, reasonably all right. But, you know, you need to be tempted when you're on night shift and, you know, tired out. And I think I existed on cornflakes. I still like cornflakes. I didn't know what else to eat. It wasn't very good at all. They didn't pander to us in that respect. I remember when quite a few Americans arrived. Breakfast improved a bit because we always had marmalade or honey something with bacon on the plate. You know, they put it all on the plate. And the Americans always like something sweet, whatever they call them, pancakes. And they got them. So we got them. They didn't come up very often, I don't think, but it was possible that you might be on duty when they were doing them.
The Action This Day letter really focused mainly on recruitment issues, but that can't have been the only problem that GC&CS was facing at that time.
Now, as we said at the start, this is a time of general crisis, not just recruitment crisis. There are lots of problems they have to deal with, just because the organisation has got so much bigger and it's starting to almost burst at the seams. The second biggest problem is probably catering. You have 1,000 staff on site and they all need to be fed. They are still doing sit-down meals in the mansion dining room. And you can imagine that would be fairly cramped with 150 people, let alone 1,000.
Did rationing have an issue with difficulties with catering as well? Was that anything to do with availability of food?
Well, it certainly affects the availability of particularly nice food. I don't think there's any evidence they ever have a problem actually finding food, although we do have plenty of veterans tell us that it wasn't particularly appetising. Yeah, you hear of people having to eat things like boiled heart at 3 o'clock in the morning. Not particularly appetising. There are other veterans, though. It may be a bit about where you come from. Some veterans who come from a maybe more modest upbringing find the food perfectly adequate and actually quite a lot better than, especially when they've been in the services. Service food is pretty awful, and Bletchley is a step up from that at least. But it's not a matter of volume. It's just a matter of getting everyone in the room and sat down and fed. During the early summer of 1941, they have up to 5 different sittings for lunch. And there's lots of memos in the archives urging people, you know, to turn up promptly for their sitting and not to stay any longer than they need to so they can get more people in. apologising for the fact that the food can't be that varied, but they can only cook a certain amount of different dishes in the mansion kitchen because it's just not large enough.
And not having second helpings as well, because then there won't be enough to go around.
Absolutely no second helpings. This is all very carefully organised to make sure they have the right amount of food and they're not wasting anything, of course. At one point, they stopped being able to offer dinner and everyone has to have sandwiches. I think that must have been because they were upgrading the facilities in the kitchen for a week or so.
That sounds rather lovely,
but
actually.
But you can imagine that probably didn't go down brilliantly. Staff were being asked to provide their own cups because we have lots of stories, I don't know how true these are, of cups going missing in the lake.
Yes.
Of course. But people would wander off with them or break them and they couldn't replace them. So people had to provide their own. And they're still using table service and waitress service.
Wow.
The modern idea of a canteen where you serve yourself, where you go up to a counter, was quite new back then. It was just coming in big munitions works in factories. That is the model that Bletchley want to follow. But up to the point they get the new canteen built, they are still doing things in a very old-fashioned way.
When was that the new canteen was built?
I think it's in April 1941 that they start planning it. It's a year until it's actually built, sort of first part of 1942. They finally get this new canteen. They can seat everyone and feed them efficiently. And then, of course, the quality of the meals, the quality of the whole operation just goes up. And
it was a big building. I mean, it's still standing. It's just outside the gates of what visitors now see as Bletchley Park.
Yeah, it's still there. In due course, that canteen itself will become inadequate for the size Bletchley grows to. But for 1942, it's a big step forward in just looking after the staff day to day. I would say, actually, during 1941, the catering is the part of the operation that comes closest to completely collapsing. They're pretty close to people literally going hungry just because they can't cook enough meals or serve enough meals for all the people working here. And that canteen, actually, that's the first of the big brick buildings which will define the second period of Bletchley Park's occupation. And it's the one they prioritise. Above office buildings, above anything else, they have to get the canteen finished, which shows you how important it was.
So with all these people on site, all these people being recruited, all these people needing to be fed, these people, I take it, also needed to be housed. But people didn't live on site at Bletchley Park, did they? Within the gate, as it
were. Yeah, very few people lived on site here. Most people were billeted in the local area in private houses. The government, you know, after the start of the war, when they'd passed the necessary legislation, the government could go around to people's houses, see if they had any spare rooms, and force them to take somebody in. Very alien concept to us nowadays, but it was wartime. But very quickly, the housing stock in this area becomes inadequate. It's not a particularly well-built-up area. The housing there is, because it's not a particularly prosperous area either. You know, most people are living in these small terrace houses where they have very little space anyway for themselves and their families, let alone lodgers. And it's an area that is quickly flooded with evacuees, because Bletchleyites are not the only people on the move. It's a time of great turmoil, of people moving all the way around the country for different reasons. It's the Ministry of Health that's in charge of organising the billets and finding places to live. It's people at Bletchley Park who actually decide which person goes into which house, because they know, firstly, about the work shifts, secondly, about security. You don't want to billet two people together if they do different jobs in case they talk to each other. They're very aware of that. And thirdly, with the transport, thinking about how they're going to bring them onto site if they have to billet them beyond walking or cycling distance. But a big step forward is in September 1941, when the Ministry of Health issues what they call a closure order on Bletchley, which means people in the local area are not allowed to rent accommodation out. They're not allowed to have visitors to take up those spare rooms. And they're not allowed to take in more evacuees. The only authority allowed to billet people in the area is Bletchley Park.
Do we know how that was received locally?
A lot of people, I imagine, were very annoyed at billeting, but I think most people understood that it was one of those things that had to happen during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, for some families, it's a bit of a boon because they get the use of the billetees ration book. And these people are fed at Bletchley. They don't need all of their personal ration. So that can go to the family and they can actually supplement their diet using that. And for some of these poorer families, that's actually incredibly helpful. And they're very sad to see their billetees go at the end of the war. You know, if you take in somebody who only drinks coffee for breakfast, then you can have their tea ration. And so it has its upsides as well. And if they need to furnish the spare room, the government provides that as well. And they get to keep that at the end of the war. So in some ways, local people can profit from the situation. Having all of these fairly wealthy people flooding into the area with steady jobs is probably actually an economic boost. The experiences of billeting vary. Some people get on quite badly with their billeters, and sometimes they have to be moved around to find somewhere where they fit in a little bit better. And there is a clash of cultures and a clash of classes in many cases. But some veterans make fantastic lifelong friends of the people who billeted them, and they're still in touch with them and their descendants up to the present day.
I'm very pleased to be interviewing Mrs. Judith Wayner, formerly Jarman, who is going to tell us about growing up near Bletchley Park in wartime. So, Judith, can you just sort of start with your story from a very young age? You know, where you...
Right. My father was having the house built because there was land being sold from Hubert Faulkner. Yes, Faulkner, the mansion, yes. And he just had the house was just finished, and they said we could either have it commandeered, I think that was what my father said, or we had to take somebody in. And we had a young girl called Elaine Parry who came from Kensington. And Elaine came from the Foreign Office, and she had the small bedroom at the front, and we had to have my cousin, or my mother's cousin, I can't remember, from Dover, and they had the big front bedroom. So I, consequently, I had to sleep on a bed with my parents, and then they left, and we had a wing commander, Montague Smith, from the RAF, and he stayed with us for a few years. But we had quite a few odd people come to stay, you know.
And this was in Wilton Avenue?
Yes, yeah.
And was it was what house that had been built just before the war?
Just before, yeah. It was finished 1939.
And one of the ones still there now, I guess.
Yeah, oh yes, very much so, yes. It's the first one in the road.
So with the organisation growing and more people coming to Bletchley Park, did the management at Bletchley Park ever consider building their own accommodation?
They did, and one of the first projects they build alongside the canteen is a hostel for civilian women. And this is to solve that problem of how you tempt young mobile women to move to this part of the country and work for you. If you can't pay them that much and they're leaving home for the first time and the parents would tend to resist them moving away and living in a billet with strangers, if you offer them a room looked after by a sort of matronly lady who can be trusted to make sure everybody is safe and happy, and you provide the meals in the canteen, then, you know, you can solve a lot of those problems. So this is what they do. And they build this hostel at the end of the road leading up to the Bletchley Park front gate. A very small part of the building still survives as a driving test centre, where I actually did my driving test myself.
Were women staying there for a long period of time then? Would you sort of get a room and be there for the rest of the war?
It seems that in most cases it was as people were introduced to the area, and then they might be moved into a billet later on to make room for somebody else. Again, experiences vary. Some of the people who lived there found it quite nice. Others found it more like a prison. And it wasn't quite as safe and secure as it was intended. There were thefts and at least, I think, one suicide. But that was one way the organisation dealt with the accommodation problem. It doesn't really scratch the surface, though, because it can only house a very small number of people compared to the number they need to house. Later in the war, there will be big military camps that are built on the fields adjacent to the park, and thousands of people will live there. But at this stage in the war, that's still, you know, not even under discussion. So the main solution is to billet. And they need to find more billets, and they have to lower the quality. Eventually, they start having to choose houses which aren't really that habitable, that don't have proper washing facilities. So they have to build shower blocks on site where people can't get a meal from the family. So they have to feed them in the canteen, and further and further away from Bletchley Park. So they have to be transported in. So as the quality of the billets gets worse, all of the other things you have to do to keep the staff happy get harder.
And adds pressure onto other departments and other teams as well.
Exactly. And they never really solve these problems with billeting, but they do manage to model through up to the end of the war and get over the line and house everyone in the meantime.
Feeding, housing, what about working? You said that they've focused on the canteen and the hostel, but how did they manage to find enough places for these people to work on site?
The thing they do after those projects, and after actually another top priority project, is building a sick bay. They start putting up these big brick office blocks, which are, you know, a reflection of the fact they're taking the task a lot more seriously than they were earlier. You can't just build prefabs. They're not going to cut it. You're going to be here for the duration. You're going to have thousands of people working here, and they're going to keep coming. So you need plenty of space for them to work in, and they need to be comfortable. So you will see when you visit us today that, you know, the space in the huts is pretty much dwarfed by these enormous blocks that sprawl over the site and really define the second period of the war. The way they managed to get this all done is actually by bringing in another government department, which is the Ministry of Works, which is responsible for all government property. Bletchley Park is handed over from SIS control to the Ministry of Works, and they take control of all the building work and things like the sewerage and the water supply and electricity and all of these things that have to happen to make the site function. And they have the resources to get these big projects done, like they do everywhere in the country.
I've heard that the buildings at Bletchley Park, those ones, the sort of long corridors and these spines that down the middle, are sort of standard Ministry of Works menu of buildings. Is that right?
Yeah, they're standard in the sense they build very similar buildings in other places. And a good example of that is actually where GCHQ goes after the war. After they've been in London, they go to Cheltenham for the first time in Benhall, and they have a similar sort of spider blocks there. They're not standard in the sense of how they're built, because actually, if you look at the buildings here, they are constructed in all sorts of strange ways, depending on what materials they could get their hands on at a particular point. The different spurs of block C are built with different arrangements of steel supports as the supplies came in. So they're not standardised or prefab in that sense, but they're pretty representative of what you get in many places across the country, absolutely. The other thing the Ministry of Works can find is labour, is workers. For most of the time the codebreakers are working here, there are at least a few hundred builders, up to, I think, about 1,000 working on the various projects. It's a building site. There would be lorries coming in, there would be piles of rubble and kind of big muddy holes everywhere as they're doing the construction. We have some accounts of veterans of falling in those in the middle of the night because it was completely, of course, pitch black as you're trying to walk across to get your dinner at 2 a.m, get your boiled heart, fall in a big ditch on the way. It's not the quaint idea of Bletchley that many of us are familiar with.
But it also makes me think of questions that we get quite often of people saying, how on earth did they manage to keep this work secret from people in the town? And it sounds like, well, there's no chance. If there's enormous building site, there's vehicles and huge numbers of people, even just to build the places, and this growth, which must have been really obvious as well.
Yeah, really obvious to the people who live around here. The thing is, they don't know what it's all for. They're sort of hiding in plain sight in a way.
I suppose the burning question is, did you pass your driving test?
Yes, I did.
Excellent. You'd say this isn't the turning point in the Bletchley Park story, but it hints at what will happen and what's to come.
Yeah, I think the real turning point comes a little bit later, around the start of 1942. But, you know, there's not one day you can say this is when things changed. It is a quite gradual process. In 1941, things are definitely started to change. I think it's probably no exaggeration to say GCNCS starts off the war not really having an administration. And they build one up, but it's tricky because they don't have enough people to run it. They don't have a lot of experience in it. There was a problem of dual control over the site with SIS. And that's where a lot of the organisational problems actually stem from. Now, the leaders of GCNCS are cryptanalysts. That was their trade. And most of the time, those people, and also the intelligence officers who come in to do that side of the work, they're not really concerned with planning for the future. They want to do what they're currently doing and do it well, but they're not very good at anticipating where things will go in the future.
So they're quite reactive to circumstance.
Yeah. And when they have to adapt, they do it in a very ad hoc way, and they come up with solutions which don't actually make a lot of sense and then have to be sorted out later and made to work in a logical way. They're not thinking about the long-term problems. But I think in 1941, we're starting to see there's a class of people above the cryptanalysts who are becoming proper managers, who are learning to have their eye on the long-term, seeing the big picture. They are pushing for things to be organised in a rational manner, maybe not getting all their ducks in a row quite as they would like, but they are pushing things in the right direction, and that's an important part of the equation as well. So I think if we are to look for a turning point in the organisation, even though a lot of these processes are sort of incremental shifts, but one really important period is early 1942, when there is a big reorganisation of the management, and this is when Denniston is moved down to London, put in charge of the commercial and diplomatic side of the organisation, and his subordinate Travis takes over at Bletchley, dealing with the service side of things and the military side of things. And that is a more important point than probably the Action This Day letter is. Although the cryptanalyst letter probably did undermine Denniston to the extent that it made his transfer more likely. But as I said before, not the only factor. It's becoming obvious that splitting responsibility between SIS and GCNCS isn't going to work anymore. Mingus actually brings in someone from the War Office, Brigadier Van Cutsem, to write a report on GCNCS about how it's working and what could be improved organisationally. And it's as a result of that that they carry out this reorganisation. Around the same time, you have the Ministry of Works coming in to organise the building. And there are all these things that happen that make the administration work a lot better. But all of that reflects, I think, a new acknowledgement from outside of Bletchley Park as a legitimate organisation and respect for the legitimacy of its work. So you could say before, it was hard to carry out those reforms because the independence of Bletchley Park as an entity just wasn't respected. And within Bletchley Park, you actually find that people working here are reconceptualising what they're doing as well. You have the creation of signals intelligence, or SIGINT, as a cohesive concept. What I mean by that is it's not that the term has just been invented. Its elements have not just been invented. There has been signals intelligence going back till at least the First World War, if not a lot earlier, depending on how you define it. But it's in World War II. And at Bletchley Park, that signals intelligence comes about as a solid, enduring concept that the people actually practicing it recognise it as such under that name. And that new conception of what they're doing here, they're not just breaking codes, they're doing signals intelligence, is summed up really well by a quote from Travis's end of year report for 1942, so the year after all of these reforms have been carried out, and he's able to be a bit more honest about what they're doing here. He says, "We believe that we should try to read every enemy signal, neglecting none, however apparently unimportant. We believe in the unholy trinity of interception, cryptography, and intelligence. We believe that communications have been the secret of German success in this war and might be ours." You don't get statements like that before this point. That's what I mean by them reconceptualising what their work is and what it means, what they're trying to achieve here. I think Bletchley Park, at the start of 1942, goes from being a code-breaking bureau to a signals intelligence centre, and that's the key shift. And the Action This Day letter, as important as it is only one part of that.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.